independent in thought, and punk rock in life. It's the Chad Benson Show.
You know, extremism is everywhere. I think, too often than not, as we've heard for a long time, we're not worried about ISIS. We're not worried about this. The biggest threat to America comes from the right and the craziness. But guess what? The left saw its craziness rear its ugly head this week, and it's been around a while. Joining us now, Brian Levin. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University of San Bernardino. Brian, thanks so much for coming on today. And we saw it for the first time in Technicolor for all of America to see that the left has an extremism problem as well.
Absolutely, the left has an extremism problem. Although, in fairness, let me just say, if we look at the data, you know, the far right, for instance, has been a much bigger threat to, for instance, law enforcement, and has been responsible for many more attacks and casualties. That being said, also violent Salafist jihadists as well. But the previous data is not as predictive or as diagnostic as we'd like for the future.
Yeah, and that's the scary part, the future part of it, because while the far right, I think we've known about the extremism groups from the Ku Klux Klan and many of the white supremacist groups and things like that, those were somewhat predictable. We see what we're dealing with here. But now you've got, was it Antifa? You've got the Black Bloc. You've got a lot of these other groups that are popping up everywhere. And it seems to be that they're coming on strong and they're loud and they're ready to start stuff with this new resistance movement against this group that, that seems to be just, quote unquote, Trump supporters or Americans.
Yeah, look, I think you make a really good analysis there. Look, if we look at, for instance, the Global Terrorism Database out of University of Maryland, my friends over there, they're really great. They showed that from right after 9/11 to 2014, far-right extremism has resulted in 131 deaths and violent Salafist jihadists only 51. We've had a much smaller number of violent events that resulted in homicides, for instance, from the far left. In fact, you know, black nationalists, if you call them the far left, have accounted for a small number, but certainly discernible number of these. And again, the thing is, it's like saying, hey, the Cubs were the World Series champions last year, so this year they'll be the world champions too. And not so much right now.
What's changing, Brian? What's changing in this world that we're seeing this kind of rise of the far left, where they're becoming more angry and more violent?
Great point, and I appreciate you having me on, because one of the things that often happens is people yell at each other on television because they're coming from a place of political partisanship. We're a nonpartisan center, so we try to look at a couple of things. One, what are the broad societal changes that are going on that influence extremism? And then within movements, what's going on? So with regard to the hard left, and let me say, because everyone I know who's progressive is going to call me and say I'm a jerk. I am not saying that in any way the hard left represented the same level of casualties, the same level of incidents, or anything like that. But what I am saying is that there are societal trends of this increasing polarization and glorification of violent tactics, demonization, and conspiracy theories that it has now been taken up by a very small splintered group of the left, which is different than the progressive left, which did like the Women's March, which was very peaceful. There's this splintered offshoot, which now is organizing on its own and not just trying to direct its actions towards violent protests, but something even more broad and maybe nefarious, and that is violence on its own. To be sure, the far right is what we regard the bigger threat, if you will. But here's the thing. You know, a lone gunman could have taken out 20 congressmen. So the fact that there is now a folklore and narrative and organization going on, organizing with a movement, doesn't mean that an unstable, angry loner could go out and do nasty things. And we have that across the ideological spectrum. What I like to say is we have the most diverse threat matrix that we've seen in years. And while the left is fledgling, the hard left is fledgling, smaller, not as organized, not as leaking into the mainstream as, for instance, the alt-right did, it's still something that we have to watch now. That blip is on the radar screen, and even if they only get some small groups or violent loners, they can do some damage.
You know, you talk about that. You know, I look at somebody like Bernie, though, and I look at Bernie in his past, and you look at who he is, and a lot of what he loved and a lot of what he did through the 60s and 70s and the way that he was very Marxist-ex, very kind of anarchist, and I think he's brought a rise to a lot of those people. And as you know, here's the thing. The alt-right and the far-right, the far-far-right, they've been there forever and a day. We know exactly who they are and what we're looking for. But the alt-left is coming together because, I mean, this isn't something new. I mean, you go back to Seattle and the World Trade Organization and things like that. This has blossomed over years, but it hasn't really been given a name until the last year or so where people have started to pay attention to this.
But what I would say is Bernie is much more, as far as a policy guy, more related to what you might call European socialism, if you will, kind of like Sweden or something. To be sure, you know, the late 60s and early 70s, we saw a very violent, and indeed, it was a much more violent time relative to how many incidents we had. By groups like the SLA, the Weather Underground, United Freedom Front, committed a lot of violence. And we had assassinations of police officers going on routinely. But I don't see in Bernie himself and the message that he was trying to promote as one that really glorified the violence that existed in the late 60s and early 70s. It really revolved around kind of this European-style socialism with respect to a $15 minimum wage and socialized health care and also socialized education. It didn't, to me, in listening to him speak, have this kind of violent undertone. Indeed, let me just say, we're a nonpartisan center. You know, Newt Gingrich was on Fox the other day, and he said, look, there's this pattern of violent rhetoric by the hard left, but he conveniently left out how on the campaign stump, candidate Trump talked about knocking the hell out of people, carrying them out on stretchers, and how he'd, quote, like to punch him in the face when talking about a counter-protester. And we saw these emboldened alt-right people like Heimbach from the Traditionalist Workers Party physically assaulting and manhandling an African-American protester and these other kinds of statements using the N-word, you know, people using the N-word in the audience and a Nazi salute and white power statement over at an Alabama rally that really was not decried. When we look at John McCain, listen to what he said on the campaign stump and listen to the beautiful concession speech that he made. That part of the Republican Party is exactly what the alt-right wanted to dismantle, this kind of centrist, conservative, but not overtly bigoted or violent kind of rhetoric. And what I'm saying is it has now crossed the fire lines, and in a more macro sense, what we've seen at inflection points, inflection elections like 68, where we had Bobby Kennedy killed and Martin Luther King killed, and we had a catalytic event like the Vietnam War going on, and then we had the Pentagon Papers, what we've seen is this unraveling of what sociologists and the Europeans call civic and social cohesion, where we're getting much more tribalistic. So if one side says, hey, the system's bad and violence is okay, that wildfire will catch on the other side of the fire line.
All right, last question. I appreciate you coming on today. Social media is playing a huge role. And obviously, the alt-right has their darlings, if you will, the people they follow, their conspiracy theorists, the Alex Joneses, the worlds and things like that. The left, though, tends to be far more organized as a younger generation because they're more into social media than the average, 65-year-old white male may be. And how is the social media side of things helping spread their kind of conspiracy theories? They got them as well, just like the alt-right does. How is it that it's getting spread and they're using it to their advantage?
They are. You know, so we have the Antifa groups, the Black Bloc, the John Brown anti-racist. And by the way, we've had this for decades. When I was doing hate rally analysis in the 90s, we saw anti-racist action and skinheads against racial prejudice acting violent at these rallies. What I think has happened is we've seen a choreographed dance between both hard sides on social media. But let me just say this. I want to be clear. The far right is much bigger, much more well-entrenched, and the actual violence that has taken place by them over the last 10 or 15 years has been among the biggest threats with regard to domestic extremism in the United States. What I am saying, though, is with respect to the hard left, which, by the way, both sides have a younger cohort of leaders. You look at Spencer on the alt-right, Andrew Anglin, who does the Daily Stormer, Heimbach, Traditionalist Workers Party. These are younger folks, and we're seeing this on the hard left as well. A younger internet social media savvy group of folks. But what we are concerned about is not the size of the hard left at the moment, but the fact that there's been a coalescence and organizing around this violent rhetoric, which is much more broad in its targeting, and this blip is now on the radar screen. But I don't want to make an equalization with regard to either the size or the recent history of extremist violent incidents.
His name is Brian Levin. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University, Santa Bernardino. We appreciate you coming on today, and we appreciate you talking to Anthony yesterday about all kinds of good stuff about where to live in Orange County. Definitely appreciate that, my man.
Thank you so much, and good luck with your Southern California show.
Thank you so much, man. Which is national, that's right. But we travel everywhere, Brian. We travel everywhere. Appreciate that. We hope to have you on again sometime.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm telling you, that was an interesting thing. And Brian, I appreciate him coming on. And we're going to touch a little bit more on that. The Chad Benson Show, Facebook, at Chad Benson Show, Twitter, ChadBenson, Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. Because I've got some stuff I think that needs to be put out there that maybe wasn't conveyed in the interview. It was a great interview. He's a great guy, nonpartisan. And I understand where he's coming from. And we're going to touch on that. Before we do that, though, let me tell you something, kids. It's the weekend. And you're saying to yourself, man, another week of long hours. I need more employees. What are you going to do to find them? Well, you can continue to do what you've been doing, or you can get super uber duber smart and go with ZipRecruiter.com. You see, at ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus sites with one click. Then they have this powerful technology that efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anyone else. This is where ZipRecruiter is unlike any other job sites out there. ZipRecruiter does not depend on the candidates finding you, right? So they're not waiting, hey, you go find. No. They're going out there and they're actively helping you find them. In fact, they end up 80% of the time placing a qualified candidate with you within 24 hours. Boom. That's amazing. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out why ZipRecruiter's been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Listeners to the Chad Benson Show, don't let the weekend be the same old weekend. Place your job for free today. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/report. That's ZipRecruiter.com/report. One more time. Place your job for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/report. You can email the show, Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. You can also text us, 323-538-2423. It's the Chad Benson Show.
If you like talk radio like Chad Benson likes his meals, you've come to the perfect place for takeout.
I found that interesting. I found that thing very interesting, Brian Levin. And I appreciate him coming on. I think, the alt-right, let's not pretend that the alt-right's not there. I see it on my page. I see it with people that go on my Facebook, and they say some horrific things. They do. And they say some stuff where I've even got to step in once in a while. And on IM, say, you need to tone it down. Tone down your rhetoric. I don't care that people argue. I don't care that people have a discussion. You know what? That's what politics is. It gets heated. It gets divisive at times. I have no problem with that. The one thing I will say is the 60s and 70s was an alt-left kind of thing, and I think we dismissed that. The Weather Underground, a lot of these other groups that did what they did, we dismissed that kind of revolutionary action because it was standing up against the man, and for whatever reason, that doesn't get counted in. The alt-left is growing, and I think the numbers are comparable to what you see on the alt-right. The difference is if you go to a Klan rally, which I think everybody should go to one just to look and see what goes on there. I really do. I think it's an educational thing. But you go there, the Klan is there for one particular reason. You go to a lot of these rallies on the left, there is more people, but they're all there for a specific thing. And that's a different thing. But they all have an underlying disgust and disdain for the president of the United States and for the right. It's just that they do it from a way of, hey, I'm here for climate change, or I'm here for race relations, or I'm here for, I don't like the religious side of the alt-right. The right. So that's what they're not there for the same reason. They all come in a particular way, but make no, never mind. There is as many as the alt-right. Are they as organized? No, because again, they're splinter groups. They're groups here of 10,000, groups here of 5,000, groups here of 1,000. But if you put them together, I think they're bigger, and I think over time, they'll be more dangerous. I do. I think they'll be far more dangerous over a period of time, especially at this moment in time, because I believe they're very much angered, and they're reactionary, and they're coming hard. You see it in colleges. It's starting everywhere, whether it's at Evergreen College up in Washington State that is at the point now where, they're going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over the professor, the white professor that won't leave on the day of absence, and they're calling him racist, and they're going after him, they're bullying. It's starting there, but it's blossoming in ways. They're going to have real problems within that party, because it's not going to be what they want. And we see what happens when they don't get what they want. The Chad Benson Show. Facebook, at Chad Benson Show. Twitter, ChadBenson. Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. You can text the program, 323-538-2423. Brian Levin is his name. Interesting guy. I think he brought some good points, but I think there's some stuff still missing. But definitely interesting. We'd love to have him on again. 323-538-2423. That's the text line. This is The Chad Benson Show.
The Chad Benson Show.
Independent in thought and punk rock in life. It's the Chad Benson Show.
This is the best of Chad Benson.
Best is over. Lasting all of 6 minutes. That's right. He blamed it on lies, blamed it on greed, blamed it on the media. I'm sure race was in there. His wife showed up today, which is, it's got to be tough hearing that. If you're Camille Camazo Hobson and Incorporated. For 2 hours on Monday, Bill Cosby's attorney flipping between stages, whispered intimacy and ear-splitting verbal explosions, ran through a long list of possible culprits. He said that are responsible for landing his client at the center of the most high-profile America history. And lo and behold, six-minute defense, bringing the case, bring closed testimony in the sexual assault, a case against the 79-year-old comedian, which I believe he's going to do time. I don't think that, 60 people, you've got to take, I know people, look, we're human beings, right? We're human beings. And unless you've lived under a rock because of social media, I'm sure finding a juror nowadays has got to be one of the toughest things in the world to do. Because of social media, because of all of the things that we have access to in a 24-hour news cycle, finding a juror who doesn't have an opinion and has not heard a lot of something, especially something high-profiled, has got to be near impossible. I'm almost at the point where if you don't have any of these things, you don't have any social media, you don't have Facebook, you don't have any of this stuff, you don't know what's going on with the world, you're a worse juror. because you're not even caught up with what's going on in the world. So it's got to be tough. And you can say all you want. Well, you can't take into account that there are 57 or 58 other people that aren't included in this trial that may have been in a similar situation or have accused him of similar stuff. You can't say as a human being, I can't take that into, because even if you're saying I can't take that into account, I will, because I'm a human being. I don't know. I think he's going down. I think he is. I think he's going to go down, and I think he is going to, he's going to pay for this. I don't know what he's going to pay for as far as, I'm sure the money's already locked up in a trust. I'm sure that stuff's untouchable. I'm sure Camille has all of it. And any woman, she should get some of it, because any woman who's willing to spend that much time with a human being, knowing full, you can't not know some of this stuff was going on, right? You can't not know, unless that was kind of the agreed upon thing that you can do what you want and you could be a Bill Cosby, the Lothario, the lewd-based Lothario out there in the world. But when you're home, you're Bill Cosby, the husband and the wife, the husband and the father and whatnot. Just throwing it out there. How addictive are cell phones? We actually talked to this guy a little while ago, but this guy, his name is Tristan Harris. He used to be a product manager at Google. Last night he was on 60 Minutes, and let me tell you something. It is eye-opening on the addiction of cell phones, apps, all of this mobile technology we have in our hands. It is beyond addicting. And it was eye-opening because he's opening up more and more about how this thing is really going in our world right now, on how they get you addicted and how they get you just wanting it more, more, and more.
This thing is a slot machine.
How is that a slot machine?
Well, every time I check my phone, I'm playing the slot machine to see what did I get. This is one way to hijack people's minds and create a habit, to form a habit. What you do is you make it so when someone pulls a lever, sometimes they get a reward, an exciting reward. And it turns out that this design technique can be embedded inside of all these products.
Yeah. Pavlov dog, right? It's the mouse that knows to get the reward where the cheese is. That's what these things are. You know, video game companies figured this out even before the phone companies and the app companies started coming on board. Video game companies figured this out. They figured a reward-based system will get people sucked in. And the first one to do it was World of Warcraft. Really do it. Where they made getting every little badge and every little thing massive. And it got people addicted to doing that. And if you go back far, like a perfect example is look at the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts. Right? My son wants to get all of his badges. This weekend he graduated, moved up I don't know what he is. He was a Cub Scout. Now he's going to Wolf Pack, whatever. I don't know. But it's all about he wants to get the badges. It's the reward system. And electronically, we have it instantaneously. It's likes, it's views, comments. Yeah, you want to see that. How many retweets did I get? How many thumbs up did I get? The reward system keeps us coming back for more.
The rewards Harris is talking about are a big part of what makes smartphones so appealing. The chance of getting likes on Facebook and Instagram, cute emojis and text messages, and new followers on Twitter.
There's a whole playbook of techniques that get used to get you using for the product for as long as possible.
Yeah. It is. They just took what other groups had done and say, how do I make this addictive? Because that's what you want. You want your product to be addictive. You want your product to be absolutely addictive. Smoking, there's a reason there are 21 in a pack, something like that. There's a reason that there are 22 in a pack. There's a reason all of these things, it's all psychological. If you find a way to get something or somebody to bite on stuff over and over again, when you go fishing, you want to have the best bait because you want to get the most bites. What works? And they have it down to the point where it's no longer an art. It's an art/science. with a little touch of human feel.
Snapchat's the most popular messaging service for teenagers, and they invented this feature called Streaks, which shows the number of days in a row that you've sent a message back and forth with someone. Kids feel like, well, now I don't want to lose my streak. Kids actually, when they go on vacation, are so stressed about their streak that they actually give their password to like five other kids to keep their streaks going on their behalf. When these features are being designed, are they designed to most help people live their life? Or are they being designed because they're best at hooking people into using the product?
Hooking it. Makes life easy. Makes life fun. Makes life enjoyable. But to get people to use your tools, your games, to play, or whatever it is, you need to have a hook. It's no longer just being interesting, right? It's no longer just being fun. It can't just be that. It has to be a rewards-based system, because we all want to achieve in some way, shape, or form. We all want to continue to go on. We all want to continue to get a slap on our back. We all want to see that thumbs up, that like, that view. We all want to see those kind of things. Yes, of course it's about making your life somewhat easier. But to make those things that way, to make those things enjoyable, you got to get people hooked.
Is Silicon Valley programming apps, or are they programming people?
Inadvertently, whether they want to or not, they're shaping the thoughts and feelings and actions of people. They are programming people.
Yeah, going to continue to do that. That's Tristan Harris, formal Google manager, product manager, who understands that this is what they do. If I was going to start an app or do something, you know what you do? Like everything else, whether it's sales or a good portion of things that go on in life, you bring in somebody who psychologically understands, because you want to get that response over and over again. So what psychologically is going to help us do this? It's emotion-based, and when you can continue to go back and forth to those emotions, you can continue to get people to hit that button over and over again. You win. And every one of you right now, and it's the same thing I've told, I've said this over and over again. You leave your wallet at home, you'll leave it at home. You're not going back to get it. You leave your phone at home, you will go back and get your phone. You will go back. Even if it plays no part in your day-to-day work life or importance, you'll make up the excuse, well, my kids need to get a hold of me. You'll make up the excuse that I need it for. No. We're addicted to our phones.
There's always this narrative that technology is neutral and it's up to us to choose how we use it. This is just not true.
Technology is not neutral.
It's not neutral. They want you to use it in particular ways and for long periods of time, because that's how they make their money.
Yeah. More eyes. More people playing your games, more people doing things like that day to day. I mean, if you look at Snapchat, which went public and has since fallen off, the hype of it. What is it? It's Twitter. It's all of these things. What do you get out of these things? Yes, you can send messages, but it's about the eyes on the prize. And if you have the eyes on the prize and you have advertisers, the people are looking, and you've got that group that matters, that young group that matters, that 18 to 24, that 18 to 36, in some cases 18 to 49, the big advertising section, that is key to something like this. And when you can do that, you win. And you win into the point of billions.
Never before in history have a handful of people at a handful of technology companies shaped how a billion people think and feel every day with the choices they make about these screens.
It is crazy, man. The addiction level. I'm addicted. I'm not afraid to say it, right? I'm addicted. I am. We all are. Most of us listening right now, most of you listening, keep your phone by the bed. You'll have your phone, your laptop, and the TV on, and you'll be paying more attention to your laptop or your tablet and your phone than the television. It's an addiction. Now, it's not crack. It's not, alcohol. You're not doing unscrupulous things to get more of it, right? You're not doing things. It's not going to drive you to the point where you're going to go, oh, my God, I'm on the streets doing things I shouldn't do because I need another app. But it is an addiction. and they want you addicted, because in the end, it has nothing more to do with anything other than money.
And it's not because anyone is evil or has bad intentions. It's because the game is getting attention at all costs. And the problem is it becomes this race to the bottom of the brainstem, where if I go lower on the brainstem to get you, you know, using my product, I win, but it doesn't end up in the world we want to live in. We don't end up feeling good about how we're using all this stuff.
You call this a race to the bottom of the brainstem. It's a race to the most primitive emotions we have, fear, anxiety, loneliness, yeah, all these things.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Because it's psychological. When you're in sales, what do? You play on people's emotions. Very rarely do people buy stuff. Most of the time, people sell things, especially big things, right? They want to know about big things, and you sell that to them. And how do you do it? You appeal on greed. You appeal on love. You appeal on all kinds of emotions. And it's the same thing when it comes to stuff like this. We're addicted. We're addicted. You know you're addicted. You're addicted to Facebook. You're addicted to Instagram. You're addicted to all of these other things. It's a new world we live in. Technology is a part of our world to the point where it is now becoming us, and we're becoming it, and the lines are blurred, but we're addicted. And there's a reason we're addicted. It was designed for us to be that way. The Chad Benson Show, Facebook, at Chad Benson Show, Twitter, ChadBensonShow.com, Chad at ChadBensonShow.com. Be addicted at Chad Benson Show. And also be addicted. Text this program as well, 323-538-2423. It's the Chad Benson Show.
You're listening to the best of Chad Benson.
America's funniest cisgendered privileged white male with a bully pulpit the size of a divided nation. Here's Chad Benson.
This is the best of Chad Benson.
Ronaldo, the soccer player, getting a crazy contract offer to go play in China. 120 million euros a year, tax-free. I was looking at some of the craziest contracts of all time. And some of them are insane, and some of them are even to this day. They're out there. Punter Johnny Hecker from the LA Rams. Apparently, he calls his contract. He named it Johnny Kickball, and it's actually the contract wording is in haiku. That's how he wanted it. You've got another person by the name of Michael Jordan. Anybody out there ever heard of him? Apparently, he had in his contract called a love of the game clause. This would, I found this to be interesting. So because he was, like most athletes, and I know when I played, most athletes, they want you to not do anything active outside of the normal, you're working out, you're keeping in shape. And they want it all now supervised in the whole nine yards. And, you know, they don't want you riding motorcycles. They don't want you doing any of this kind of stuff. And they don't want you really playing unless it's a sanctioned kind of thing where you're with a national team or something like that. Well, he was so competitive that he had the Chicago Bulls in 1988 put in a love of the game clause, meaning if he wanted to play basketball with a bunch of kids at a park, because he was competitive and he wanted to do it, they couldn't stop him or they couldn't take his contract away saying, you hurt yourself, not on our time, so you're screwed. And speaking of traveling or doing something crazy, Stefan Schwartz, an ex-English Premier League soccer player, he actually spent money to go to space, and they worked in a deal that he could not go to space if he was going to sign this contract, even though he had spent money on that. This one I found to be awesome. So Raleigh Fingers, a great baseball player, the guy with the sweet handlebar mustache, he didn't start that. Reggie Jackson actually came to camp with a mustache back in the day, and Charlie Finley wasn't excited about it, but said you don't have to shave it. But he then said to everybody, "Hey, we're gonna have mustache night. So every one of you who grows a mustache, you get $300 for mustache night." He grew one, put the handlebars on, and then he agreed that they would give him $100 a year worth of mustache wax to keep it going because it became an iconic thing. These are the kind of fun stuff right here, though. Texas Rangers, baseball player, who is one of the young stars in baseball. this is great. Odor signed the contract this year, was offered a massive contract. He wasn't thrilled by it. He had some other people that he was talking to, other state teams. But they know he loves horse racing. So after they had presented him with a contract, they slide over pictures of racehorses that were going to be his if he signed the contract. Lo and behold, Odor is still a Ranger because of racehorses. Don't you want that? Don't you want to be like, I want your petty cash. I'm going to sign this contract today, and I want your petty cash. I want the box it's in. I want your shoes. You want stuff. You want to get to that point in life where people offer you stuff. Like, what do you want? I want the house. I want some weird dog that you can't find but eight of them on the planet. That's how big you want to be in life. Solid fun show today. Always good to end it in something a little bit more lighthearted. Text the program, 323-538-2423. Take our polls at Chad Benson Show. Simple and easy. C-H-A-D-B-E-N-S-O-N. Like us on the Facebook, Chad Benson Show. Have yourself a good rest of your Monday. For Luis, for Anthony, my name is Chad Benson. Night-night, Jack.
This is the best of Chad Benson.
This is the Chad Benson Show.